PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Good to have Ellen Brown back again. We'll talk about the economy, everything in it that's rotten. I also absolutely have to mention Ellen's newest book, when Ellen comes on. Earlier we talked extensively about Web of Debt, and the natural follow-up to Web of Debt is the public bank solution from austerity to prosperity, and Ellen nails it cold. She tells the story cold. She tells the story the way everybody needs to understand it. And Ellen, you've got a couple of new articles, and maybe I can preface it by a couple of comments that Paul Craig Roberts made in, I believe, his newest article. He was in the heart of the beast, Ellen, back in the 1980s, Treasury official under Ronald Reagan. How about a Reagan Treasury official talking like this, Ellen? American capitalism itself is an illusion. All financial markets are rigged, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and so on. Well, that's telling it like it is, and Ellen, you should tell it like it is. And your two newest articles that I have, unless you've got something a little newer, Wall Street Greed, Not Too Big for a California Jury, and the Global Banking System is Rigged, and the FDIC is Suing. Well, I say, hit them again harder. Ellen, talk about your newest articles and the fact that we have a rotten, corroded system. I mean, it just needs to disintegrate under its own weight. I think maybe if we give it a little push, it's going to happen one of these days.
I agree. The first thing we have to do is expose how bad our current system is. Well, and probably, unfortunately, the second thing that has to happen will be we'll start having bail-ins or something, some shock that wakes people up. No doubt there's another collapse coming, because Dodd-Frank certainly didn't fix the problems that precipitated the 2008 collapse. But anyway, so what I wrote about in those two articles was that 16 of the world's largest banks have been caught, I mean, this is sort of old news, caught rigging the LIBOR rate. So they are a cartel, an illegal cartel. These are the world's largest banks, including the three largest U.S. banks, which is JPMorgan Chase, Citigroup, and Bank of America. So they're part of this LIBOR rigging scheme. And suits have been brought before, but they were generally under RICO and Sherman Antitrust. So they were claims for anti-competitive behavior. And they were all consolidated in New York under one judge. And she ruled, rather suspiciously it seems to me, she ruled that they weren't engaging in anti-competitive behavior because they weren't intending to compete with each other. They were intending to cooperate with each other. Well, yeah, they were intending to compete unfairly with everybody else, with the other banks and with all the other, with the counterparties to their interest rate swaps. The interest rate swaps are now the biggest of the derivatives, and derivatives, of course, are out of sight, but interest rate swaps are over $400 trillion in trades, which is something like seven times the gross domestic product of all the countries in the world. And the biggest derivatives players are the American banks. So those three banks plus one other, which is Goldman Sachs. So the FDIC has now sued in March for breach of contract and fraud. So those are ordinary remedies that you can bring in state court. They're not dependent on a federal judge. And so that's what I was writing about, is that if the FDIC is suing on those claims, and you can get not just, you get triple damages for a RICO violation, but you can get many times that. I mean, juries have awarded like 30 times damages in ordinary fraud cases. And then I wrote about different entities that have been totally defrauded by the whole, not just the LIBOR rate manipulation, but the whole interest rate swap scheme itself, which is a bit complicated, and I could go into it. But the most rigging part of the scheme is that interest rates were pushed to extremely low levels by the Federal Reserve itself, which, as we know, is the head of the private banking system. I mean, it's composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their districts. So it is private, and the biggest by far is the New York Fed, which manipulates pretty much what the Fed does. So it served these big derivatives banks to push interest rates to extremely low levels in order to, they get the benefit of these swaps, and the parties that are hurt are the counterparties. So that would be cities, states, universities, hospitals. It's mostly public entities that got into these interest rate swaps. So I think it's a way to, A, get our money back, which even when they do these suits, like when the attorney general sues, they just come up with some big fines, and we don't get the benefit of the fines. They go somewhere in the federal government. But if, let's say, the University of California was a big victim of these interest rate swaps, if they sued, that money would go back to the university. It could reduce tuition. I mean, they've had to increase tuition to pay for those swaps. And, you know, just generally benefit people locally.
Ellen, I'm for something in America like what's... I don't want to talk about Ukraine today. I want to talk about money, banking, finance, the economy. But the analogy to what's going on in eastern Ukraine is very relevant at the same time. I mean, ordinary people simply will not tolerate living under a system that is totally counter to their fundamental rights. I think that really is the bottom line for them. They believe that they have fundamental rights, and indeed they do, under international law, as do we all. And to be forced under a system that violates these fundamental rights is a gross violation of what these people deserve, what everybody deserves. And they're putting their bodies on the line to fight this system and get something better. And I think that's exactly what we need in America, Ellen. We need ordinary people to realize that they are being scammed, they're being exploited, their futures are being stolen. Literally everything that they can benefit under, all the benefits that people used to have in America are literally being destroyed little by little by little, incrementally. And unless they put their bodies on the line and fight to stop this thing, it's going to get worse and worse. But if they do fight to put their bodies on the line to fight it, I think they're going to win. I think the people in eastern Ukraine could come out a winner in this thing, and I think the people of America could come out a winner of this thing, and the same thing in Europe. How much unemployment can you tolerate, Ellen? How much poverty? How much homelessness? How much hunger? How much human misery? How much can people tolerate before doing something? To go out on a street protest for a day or two, oh, stay home and watch a movie or go out to the movies. You waste your time going to a protest. It angers me to see these things. I mean, they really are a waste of time. The only way to do something is to get out, put your body there, sustain the struggle. When you protest, you make it a sustained one. It's not one where you turn the switch on, you turn the switch off, you turn it on, and you leave it on. And that's the way real change comes, Ellen. And one of these days, I think something like that may happen. But I don't know what people are waiting for. We need to do that right now.
Yeah, well, I think one major problem is people don't know how to act in a positive way, or, you know, they don't really know who the culprit is, and so they don't know what solution to push for. Most people, I mean, many people are aware that they've lost their jobs or lost their homes. I mean, they know there's something deeply wrong about the system, but they tend to blame the government, particularly, you know, people in the South that watch Fox News or whatever, you know, people that just turn on the news for a few minutes. I used to do that when I was a busy mother and attorney, and, you know, I'd just turn on the top of the news and get 5 minutes of news and thought I knew what was going on in the world. So they tend to think that the government is to blame, and so they don't support anything the government tries to do. But what they don't realize is our government has been co-opted. I mean, it's not our government. Government itself is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It should be our government. So we need to take our government back in some way. And the real culprits here, the parasites, are the big banks. And it's not even just all banks, but most local cooperative community banks are friendly, you know, ordinary people just trying to make loans and so forth, make business loans and homeowner loans, student loans or whatever. But the real culprits are those big Wall Street banks that are gambling with our money, building, they're leveraging it so that they're creating loans upon loans upon loans in the repo market, which is the shadow banking system. I mean, it's things that are so obscure, most people don't even know that they're going on. And so those are the parties that we need to get. But there's really no way. Eric Holder, the attorney general, has said they're too big to prosecute, basically, meaning that if you threw those guys in jail, this is the way Catherine Austin Fitz explained it, which I thought was pretty insightful. She said the government and the big banks are in partnership. They need those big banks to launder their money so they can carry on what we're doing in, you know, our military sovereignty abroad. So they need those crooks. And if they throw them in jail for the crooked things that the government has actually, you know, this would be basically the military, the black shadow government has agreed with them to do, then nobody else will step up to replace them. So we have to keep those crooks in place because we need the crooks. But, of course, it's not we. It's not us, the people. It's that part of the government that, or it's whoever has taken over our government. So anyway, of course, my whole push is that we really can't fight Wall Street directly, and we can't fight Washington directly. They're too powerful, and they've got all those. We don't want to get tasered or run down by tanks or something. But what we can do is set up our own system. So set up our own state-owned banks, county-owned banks, city-owned banks, and we can sue them in the ordinary legal way. They're not going to taser us for suing them if we have good claims. So that's what I was just writing about, is the potential for some really serious lawsuits, like all across the country, because there are so many public entities that have been hurt by this proven, what's now a proven fraud.
Helen, I agree with you. A very effective way to fight the existing system that's just killing us is to opt out of it and adopt an alternate system. And one way that apparently Russia is taking against America, we have to wait to see how this unfolds, and it takes a little bit of time. A lot has to go into implementing this, but the idea of trading outside the U.S. dollar, the strength of America's economy and military machine and everything related to both, its political power as well, is the strength of the dollar as the world's reserve currency. You destroy that status, and you literally, it's like Samson's here, you cut that here, and you destroy the power. And Russia and China, among other countries, are making moves to trade bilaterally in their own currencies, bypassing the dollar. When you get into oil, you bypass the petrodollar. I mean, if this thing takes hold, and if it spreads, that to me is about as effective a way as I know to really destroy American power, which relates right to the military, to its economic power, and there's a very good possibility that's exactly what will happen, and it can happen without firing a shot. I think that's a marvelous thing, and ordinary people can do the same thing. And of course, your solution, Ellen, is the right system for people here in America, a public banking system, opting away from the Wall Street-controlled private banking system. That is a terrific way, and you can do it locally, you can do it in a community, you can do it in a town, you can do it in a city, you can do it in a state, and maybe one day we can do it nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know there's a debate on whether bringing down the dollar would, first of all, I don't know that the dollar can be brought down in the sense that it doesn't matter to us if they dump our bonds because the Federal Reserve can buy them with quantitative easing. I mean, there is whether the government will actually do the sensible thing, I don't know, but they could certainly keep the dollar afloat for our purposes. And there's that thing called the Triffin dilemma, that it's not really good for you to be the global reserve currency because everybody wants your dollars, and therefore you're forced to always be running a trade deficit. In other words, they want your money, and so you wind up buying their products, and we wind up being more in debt to them than they are, you know, we wind up buying their products and they're not buying our products. So it seems to me that it would certainly hurt our black ops military operations, but it would not, and our banks perhaps, but it would, big banks, but it would not necessarily hurt us, we the people, and our trade system, you know, our own local economy. We don't really need, they did need, in 1971 when the dollar went off the gold standard, the dollar did sink, and that's why they got together, some big bankers and Henry Kissinger got together in 1973 in with Sweden and agreed to support the dollar with oil, and then we saw that this deal with the OPEC countries, and where Kissinger allegedly said, we are going to make you very rich, we are going to quadruple the price of oil, but in return you will sell your oil only in dollars, and you will put your dollars in our U.S. and London banks, which did happen, and they did manage to quadruple the price by, you could argue about what started that war, but nobody really knows exactly what that war was about. I don't think that little, I've forgotten the name of the war, was it, you know, it was a brief war there in the Middle East where there was an embargo, and that drove the cost of oil up. So then the other countries didn't have enough in reserve to buy the oil that they needed, so they had to borrow from our banks, and that put them in debt to our banks. So that certainly helped our banks, and that kept the dollar up. But we don't need that anymore. I mean, that our dollar is still, I mean, I think it will still be the dominant reserve currency for a long time, because, you know, certainly within our own trades, and I don't see why it matters if Russia and China, they should be able to trade in their own currency. There's no reason why they should need the dollar. Anyway, it remains to be played out, but I don't really see the logic of why that's going to suddenly bring down the dollar. It could suddenly hurt our big banks, but to me, that's a good thing. So.
Well, my thought is that if enough countries simply get out from under the dollar and trade bilaterally in their own currencies, or maybe some kind of a super currency is created as an alternative one. I know China, from what I've read, is very, very interested in doing more and more trade in its renminbi. And with the situation in Ukraine and the reverberations against Russia, it appears that Russia wants to do exactly the same thing. And there are other countries that are doing it, I think, to a modest degree. Well, I mean, if literally people don't give a damn about the dollar and will buy oil in currencies outside the petrodollar, well, I guess we'll have to wait and see how this plays out, Ellen. But it certainly will make interesting monitoring to see what happens. And it very well could end up switching the global chessboard around a little bit and causing a few ripples to America and adding some strength elsewhere and just changing the scene altogether. I forget what the war was in 1973. I'm thinking, what? Oh, you mean, I know what you mean. October 1973, the Yom Kippur War.
Yeah. Right, Yom Kippur War.
That's the one. Oh, I remember the quadrupling of oil prices, and I know exactly where I was when that war
remember
was fought.
Standing in line for your gas.
Well, I stood in line for gas like everybody else once the prices went up and the quantity went down, and the only way you could beat the system a little bit was if you needed gas, you just got out there very early in the morning and queued up in a short line before it just went on interminably. But I remember that, and again, I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing in October 1973, the Yom Kippur War. It caused a lot of ripples for a while, and then things played out, and life went on. And then we had 1979, the Iranian Revolution, round two.
Yeah, and then 1980, interest rates went up to 20%. So right. All these little countries that had borrowed all this money on variable interest rates suddenly had debts. They'd paid it off, technically. They'd paid as much money as they borrowed, and yet they were still more in debt than they were before because of these horrible interest rates.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, America rigged the system. I mean, literally set the system up to be the way it wanted. And I guess Kissinger was one of the players, but the financial types in Wall Street very, very much involved. And we see the situation that developed. I mean, literally, America got stronger, not weaker. So I guess it's very hard to know just exactly what's going to happen going forward if there's a lot of reshuffling now. But I'd like to see powers outside of America do the reshuffling. So I have a little hope that maybe something might turn out from this that can be good instead of the way it's always happened in the past. But again, we'll have to wait and see, Ellen. We just don't know.
Yeah, well, and if we're creative, I mean, it could be the opportunity for our for the people in Washington to actually change our monetary system. And that was another thing that's just recently in the news, that in the UK, in March, the Bank of England came out with a directive saying that they're finally admitting what money reformers have been saying for decades, that contrary to popular belief, banks don't actually lend their depositors money. They actually create the money they lend on their books. So then Martin Wolf came out with an article last week, I think, saying that we shouldn't be allowing banks to create our money, that 97% of money is created by banks. I mean, that's another thing money reformers have been saying for decades, including me, and that we should take back that power. And so he was promoting the 100% reserve solution, which I don't really think would work. But they started this big debate, and Paul Krugman weighed in, and he said, well, they're overlooking the fact that it's not all, you know, 97% isn't deposits. There's also this shadow banking system, which is the repo market, and that if the deposit system is shut down, or lending through deposits is shut down, or the, you know, leveraging of that system, then there'll just be more flight into the shadow banking system, among other arguments why it seems to me that wouldn't work. But the fact that we're shining a light on that, the fact that banks are creating our money and that they're taking huge fees and huge interest unnecessarily, that we could be doing that ourselves. You could take, let's say that the whole world is suddenly not using our dollar and we're sort of forced on our own resources. The Federal Reserve could direct its quantitative easing to productive purposes. That's what, I mean, look at Korea was absolutely flattened when they started this new monetary system where they had centrally directed credit credit from central banks from publicly owned banks that was directed toward their industries. So instead of allowing this bank created credit to go into speculative things, which is where most of our credit goes today, speculation by the big banks largely, you only allow that credit creation for building things and for, you know, things that the country needs. So aim that credit power to businesses where it should have been aimed all along. So use that quantitative easing power for something useful for the country. I mean, certainly many countries have started from scratch and built themselves up using their own credit system, like the American colonies, for starters. They were probably the best model. And Australia in the 1910s and early 20s, and New Zealand did it for a while, and Canada did it for, I think, 35 years. In the 1970s, it used to be that governments did borrow from their own government-owned central banks, but in the 1970s, there was this stagflation thing going on, partly because of that artificial hike in oil prices, and everybody thought it was because the governments were printing money and causing inflation, but that really wasn't the cause. But that's when the whole policy shift, you had your central bank direction, Bank of International Settlements, Basel Committee direction, requiring governments to borrow privately, borrow on the private market, as if this would somehow stabilize the money system. But what it actually did was cause more inflation, because it just added to the debt, which had to be paid back with interest that wasn't in the system, so somebody else had to take out more debt, and those debts had to be added onto the price of things, or the cost of interest had to be added onto the price of things. So anyway, we could reverse all that. So maybe some good slap in the face, a wake-up call, like losing our global reserve status would do it.
Well, I'm for all the slaps in the face to this arrogant empire as possible, Ellen. I'm old enough to remember when I bought my first car in 1960, Ellen, a Volkswagen Beetle, you could buy a gallon of gasoline for a quarter. And if there's a gas war, you could buy it somewhere in the teens, 19 cents, 18 cents, 17 cents. I mean, dirt cheap. And I remember one time I drove from Philadelphia, where I was at the time, to Boston. It's about a 300-mile drive, and I drove the first 200 miles, stopped in Hartford to fill up my tank, and the tank was, I had a Volkswagen that didn't have a gas gauge. Can you imagine producing a car that doesn't have a gas gauge, so you don't know how much gas you have left? They had a lever on the floor that, I forget exactly how it worked, but you got an alert in some way that you were down to your last so many miles, maybe a half a gallon, or maybe a gallon of gas, or a half a gallon of gas. That's all you had left, and this was your cue that you had to stop. I don't remember whether I hit that trigger or not, but I stopped at a gas station in Hartford, which was about 200 miles from Philadelphia, filled up the tank, and the guy, when attendants did the filling up for you, and the attendant came to my car window and said, "That will be $1, please."
I said
in response, no, I'd like you to fill the tank. He said, well, I did fill it.
I can remember going to the gas station and getting like a dollar's worth of gas because, you know, that's all I had with me. But that was actually enough to get you somewhere. And it was 25 cents when I first started driving. It reminded me of a joke. There was a, you know, the old man was telling his grandkids about, "Oh, when I was a kid, gas was 25 cents a gallon." And the kids were saying, "Grandpa's delusional again," or something. But, of course, on the other hand, my first job, I made $1.25 an hour, so.
Oh, well, I remember those days. My goodness, in college and grad school, it was in the 1950s. I guess it must have been probably the early 1950s when I was still in high school. I started working summers when I was 16 years old. Not certain if I was supposed to do it back then, but I did, and got, you know, you got nothing. You got nothing for wages, including working in a restaurant where you could pick up a few tips on the side. But it was pretty meager, but it was lovely having my first car, and very, very cheap. Cheap to buy. Brand-new Volkswagen in 1960. Brand-new. Off the rack, as they say, $600. $600. I don't know what a VW. Do they still make the Beetles? I think they may still make them. But if you buy a new Volkswagen today, I don't know what the price is. But you sure can't buy one. You can't buy a used one. It's maybe a real old one for $600. But that was really a steal. A few years later, I got another one. Then I gave up my Volkswagens and I graduated to something better. But I still look back at those days as the good old days.
Yeah, I have a friend who's even older than we are, who it remembers in the 1930s that you could hitchhike around and you could work for the night. Like he and a friend did this. They were teenagers. They hitchhiked at different places and then they would work for the night and they would make enough money to pay for their food and lodging just by doing dishes at some restaurant. And then they would go on to the next place. You could never do that today. You couldn't. No way would they take you, for starters. You'd have to do all this, fill out all this paperwork and prove who you were. And you just couldn't work for one evening washing dishes and pay your hotel and a meal. You couldn't even probably pay for the meal.
Well, Ellen, I certainly agree with that. I mean, my goodness, things relative today price-wise was so different way back when I was in college and in grad school. I literally, through summer jobs, part-time jobs at school, pay for the great majority of my tuition, and I got through college. I got a little help from my parents. I paid for my college, including 2 years room and board living at school, the rest of it entirely on my own. In grad school, I paid it all myself except $200, a $200 loan that I took out for the little bit that I couldn't fill in on my own. And of course, even in those days at a much lower cost of living, I was easily able to get rid of that debt with none of the student loan burdens that the kids have today, easily within the first year, doing it very modestly, very, very slowly, without breaking a sweat, as they say. And things have really changed so drastically now. And I don't know how the kids do it. I simply could not do what the kids put up with today. But in my time, in my day, it really was a piece of cake going through this and getting things done. But again, yeah, the world has certainly changed.
I was just writing about that the average student debt for an undergraduate is $20,000, and there are lots of graduate students who, and I had a young woman working for me she was doing typing for me. She had two master's degrees, and she's $200,000 in debt.
Oh, my goodness.
No way she can get out of debt. She lives with her boyfriend, but she can't get married because he's afraid to take on her debt. So that's typical for a lot of people these days. They're in a horrible situation.
Oh, it really is. Well, the student loan situation literally is a racket. I wrote several times about it. I had chapters in both of my Wall Street book and my Backyard Occupation book. I had chapters on the student loan racket in both of them. And it really is a scam, and there's no way you can get out of it. You know, you can get out of a lot of debts by declaring bankruptcy, or at least getting out from under to a great degree. But there is no way possible, unless you die or you leave the country, to get out from under your student loan debt. And the loan originators love it when kids can't pay their debt, because they simply add on penalties, other add-ons, all kinds of things onto the obligation, and it just keeps the debt keeps mounting and mounting and mounting, and literally in some cases you get out of school indebted, and for the rest of your life you're never out from under, and they can garnish your wages, they can take your retirement income. I mean, you're really plain stuck, Ellen. This is the system that exists today, and it was instituted under Bush, and Obama made it meaner and nastier.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're literally debt slaves, and I think that was probably the idea. They don't necessarily want the young people to be awake and doing creative things and really investigating what's going on. But it could be fixed. That's another thing that could be fixed with quantitative easing. You could buy up $1 trillion in student debt and rip it up. And, the Federal Reserve could. Or they could be giving 0.75% loans like they give to banks. But the argument is, well, banks are good credit risks and students are bad credit risks. But why are the banks good credit risks? Because the government supports them. If the government hadn't supported them, they'd be bankrupt right now after the 2008 collapse. So if what you could do is guarantee the students a job after they get out of school. That's not outrageous. That was actually done in Costa Rica, and it worked brilliantly well. Virtually like two-thirds of the country was in one way or another either employed by the government or employed by some company that made things for the government, and the economy just boomed after that. Of course, another thing that the president did, it was after they had a revolution, I think in 1949, was to get rid of the military. There were a couple of coups, and he decided he didn't need this military anymore, and so he just got rid of it. So, I mean, think what that would do to our budget if we got rid of our military. We'd have twice as much money, literally.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it's my dream. You know, people think if the military was cut in half, it would be a wonderful thing to do. Cut in half? We ought to cut 90% of it. Who is an enemy of America? I defy anybody listening to this program to tell me one nation that's an enemy of America and threatens to attack America, to harm the U.S. national interests, either at home or abroad. And I guarantee you will come up with the number zero if you try to find something. And I've said so many times, Ellen, that the only enemies America has are the ones that it invents. Did Saddam threaten to attack America? No. Did the Taliban? No. Did the Libyans, the Gaddafi, the Libyans? No. The The Eastern Ukrainians, or even the Western Ukrainians, or even their neighbors? No. I mean, literally no enemies at all. So they're invented to stoke the military machine to benefit the war profiteers. And of course, that includes the bankers have their dirty hands in everything, whether it's wars or anything else. The bankers are very much involved. So this is what the game, is to, you know, you spend money on the military, get government money, going into these companies, all kinds of companies making money, The story that's never told is that there are much better ways to benefit corporate America than by waging wars. If you put government money into civilian programs, you can create better profits over the long term than by doing what we're doing now. But you never hear that. Of course, the Lockheed Martins and Boeings and people like that, I mean, they need wars to produce weapons. So for them, war making goes directly to the products that they make. But, I mean, bankers and other companies that benefit from wars, I mean, when you fight a war, you need a lot more than weapons. You need all kinds of things. I mean, everything from toothpaste to toilet paper to food. I mean, you name it. If you take that money and put it into civilian stuff, my goodness, I mean, just building roads and bridges, you can create all kinds of profits for companies. All kinds of stuff can go into generating economic growth. And forget the name of the author who's been gone for a number of years, over a decade now, and he proved it. He wrote about it in a number of books where he showed that economic development on the civilian side is much better overall to the profits of corporate America, they're doing it on the military side. So it really begs the question, Ellen, why are we doing it the wrong way and not the right way? And I'd sure like to hear a good answer to that.
Well, it seems to me that it's actually our largest socialist engine is the military. I mean, it's totally government-supported, sort of cradle-to-grave benefits. But if you did that as a civilian, I mean, that's what they should do, is put all that energy into a civilian sort of socialist enterprise. In other words, a civilian big corporation that would, like you say, build roads and bridges and do all the things that the country needs. But everybody would protest vigorously that was socialism and that we can't do that. So we're just discreetly, quietly supporting this whole industry. Our biggest industry is the military, but it's a government-owned industry. It's a socialist industry.
Well, Ellen, of course, we have socialism for the rich, and we have free market capitalism for you, me, and everybody listening to this program.
Right.
That's the system. In other words, we're on our own, sink or swim, and the big boys, whether they're the banks or whatever, the auto companies, you name it, they get into trouble, and they get our money to get them back on their feet. I read a little blurb, I think it was today, maybe it was yesterday, that the taxpayers lost 11 point something billion dollars in the General Motors bailout. I would think it was a lot more than that, but we're talking about a lot of our money poured in to save General Motors from going under. If General Motors couldn't save themselves from going under, and none of our money should have done it for them. In my small family business, Ellen, the notion of our getting government help to save us from going under would have been absolutely laughable had we ever approached a government agency to help us when we got in trouble. And we were in a very cyclical business, and we sure did get in trouble a number of times, and by sheer luck we saved ourselves from going under. But I guarantee you, not one red cent of government money ever would have gone to help us in any way. But if we changed our name from the Lendman Group to General Motors Group, well, that would have changed the game.
Yeah. Well, before Dodd-Frank, the Federal Reserve was able to, or maybe it was the government itself, I've forgotten, was able to target specific companies like that and bail them out. I mean, there were a number of private companies that got bailed out. But now Dodd-Frank says that they can only target a class of debtors or whatever in order to help them, to bail them out. And so it seems to me that what they should do is target the class of state and local governments that are they've all been crippled by banking profligacy. So why not make loans to local governments at 0.25% interest, just like they did to the banks that they bailed out? instead of forcing those governments to borrow at high interest rates and be stuck with interest rate swaps and the bond vigilantes and all the things that, you know, make them fall into lockstep and do what the creditors want, they could be getting very cheap loans. Well, in fact, that's what they do in North Dakota. Basically, the Bank of North Dakota is the funding mechanism for, so they, the government there can, when it went over budget one year, they just hit up their credit line with the Bank of North Dakota, like virtually free money, the same as the big banks can get from the Federal Reserve. And then the next year they were back on their feet and straightened out. I mean, they didn't have this huge debt burden that was the debt itself burdening them with, or the financing charges for the debt itself accumulating double the cost of what they were borrowing. The Bay Bridge retrofit was $6 billion. When you add on interest and bank fees, it's $12 billion, doubled the cost. The first leg of the bullet train in California is $10 billion. When you add on interest and fees, it's going to be $20 billion, again, doubling the cost. So if you either had access to the Federal Reserve at borrowing basically interest-free, or to your own bank, if the Fed's not going to do it, set up your own state-owned bank and get that money interest-free, you could cut the cost of all that infrastructure in half.
That would be a wonderful thing to do. If it could only be a significant breakthrough, Ellen, with something like this can happen. There's a lot going on in California. Is there anything new, both statewide? Well, of course, with Jerry Brown around, I guess there's no chance to get public banking in California, but I wonder if it would make any difference with a different Democrat or Republican. But what's new? I haven't followed the San Francisco story.
There might be a chance with Jerry Brown. I was interviewed by the LA Times, you know, I'm running for California State Treasurer, and she said, the woman that interviewed me said that she had interviewed Jerry Brown, and she said, what do you think of a state-owned bank? You know, he vetoed our bill. We had a bill that passed both houses of the legislature, and he didn't sign it, but it was a bill for a feasibility study, and his argument was that we had plenty of committees, and we didn't need another committee, and it could be done by their banking committee, but they never followed through on it. But anyway, he told this reporter, she said, what do you think of a state-owned bank? And he said, well, I'm not opposed to it. I just don't know much about it. So it seems to me right now he's in a bind. Well, that bullet train, for one thing, is going to be a huge albatross around his neck because it's costing much more money than it was originally projected. But he's not letting go of it, apparently. So a state-owned bank would be a way to fund it much more cheaply than what they're looking at right now. But I saw that he just now is recommending it turns out that California has a surplus this year because they've done all these horrible cutbacks, which have hurt the poor, of course, more than anybody else. But having slashed their budget to the bone, they've managed to come up with a surplus. So now he's recommending putting the surplus in a rainy day fund so that the next time we have a crisis like this, we'll have the money and we won't have to go through what we went through before. But then all the other interests are clamoring, no, we need that money for education. We need to hire those teachers back that got laid off, or, you know, all the different constituencies want to use the money for the things that they've been cut back on. So it seems to me that you could have your cake and eat it too. I was thinking of writing on this next. By taking that rainy day fund money and using it to capitalize a bank. And then you can then leverage your, and put all, run all your payroll, et cetera, all the government's revenues, run that through the bank. You would have a huge capital base, a huge depository base, and you could then make loans for all those things that the state needs, particularly the things that pay back, the things that are called self-funding loans, which would be like the Bay Bridge retrofit, you know, things that you can actually charge a toll for, or the energy things that, or water, things that you can charge for so that the loan actually gets paid back. Then you can create money in the form of credit on your books, spend it, and you'll still have the money in the bank for when you need it. I mean, if you have to keep rolling over the loan, that's okay. You don't need to pay the loan back because you don't owe interest on it. It's just gonna, you're just gonna be carrying this debt on your books, just like the federal government is now close to $17 trillion in debt, and we're not bankrupt yet. I mean, we can carry that debt indefinitely except for the interest. It's the interest that grows exponentially. But if you just had it as a debt, interest-free, you could carry it indefinitely, and I would argue you should carry it indefinitely because the debt really is our money supply. All of our money comes from credit or debt, except for a teeny bit in the way of coins. Even dollar bills get into the system in the form of debt. So if you've got a debt on one side or a liability on one side of your balance sheet, if you're going to have credits or something you could spend on the other side of your balance sheet, you've got to have some liabilities on the other side. So you need that debt. The debt is sort of the shadow, shadow entity, the negative, the yin and yang of our money supply.
And the important point that you raise, Ellen, with a public bank, you could carry this debt interest-free, literally have this debt at zero interest. It would be wonderful. And I would add one more thing. If Jerry Brown claims he doesn't know much about public banking, well, my feeling, Jerry, if you're listening today, let me just tell you, read Ellen's two books and you'll be an expert on the subject. Both The Web of Debt and The Public Bank Solution, you'll know as much about public banking as Ellen does. Send him copies, Ellen. Maybe that would jog him a little bit to do something.
Well, actually, that's a good idea. I feel like maybe I did give him a copy. I met him once and shook his hand, but, you know, it was in one of those things where there's a lot of people there.
Passing through the night.
But we're in Los Angeles now. We're looking at forming, we have a small group that's working on forming a city-owned bank. The city of L.A. is 5 times the population of North Dakota, and it's the county of L.A., I think, is 18 times the state of North Dakota. So we've easily got the assets to form a bank. If North Dakota can do it, we can do it. And it turns out the city is another one of these victims of interest rate swaps. I think the first thing they should do is sue for fraud and breach of contract like the FDIC has done. Get out of those interest rate swaps. You can get rescission for a breach of contract even if you don't establish fraud. That means you can call off the deal, which is otherwise they have to pay these huge fees, and that's why they're stuck with these deals even though they're very bad deals. But besides that, it turns out besides their huge interest burden, which it seems to me, I think it's $200 million in interest annually, but they are also paying $200 million in bank fees, as much in fees as they're paying in interest, actually somewhat more in fees than in interest. So all the bank fees could be saved if we had our own bank. In San Francisco, I know that the largest, I think half of their bank fees go to credit card payments. So they take a lot of their payments on credit cards, and just like everybody else, every other merchant, the city has to pay 2% to Visa and MasterCard when they take those payments. So if they owned the bank, they would be able to keep, you know, Visa and MasterCard are just conduits, sort of. So it's the bank, the receiving bank, that gets most of that 2%, so that they could keep that money if they were doing their own banking and doing their own credit cards, et cetera. They could still be in the Visa and MasterCard system, and they would still get to keep the bulk of those fees. So there's just so much money you could save if you did your own banking in-house. And a lot of people are recognizing that now. So the steam is building, I think. I read somewhere that it only takes 3% of the tipping point is at 3%. When you get 3% of people who realize something and really push for it, then you can tip the thing over. So I think that's what Jerry Brown is waiting for, is a groundswell of support. I mean, I heard someone else say that he had said that privately, that good idea, make me do it sort of thing, like Roosevelt said, make me do it, with a groundswell of support, because of course he's going to go up against the big banks, which are his big supporters. So he's got to be able to say, well, it's not me. You know, the populace wants this, so I have to do it.
Ellen, if it ever breaks through in California, it really will be a breakthrough for the country. Usually the ideas that the good are bad, I should say, that emerge in America, begin in the West, and of course California is the heart of the West, and then they head east. But of course California is by far the largest state. What is it, the world's sixth largest economy? I mean, just
it was the sixth, now it's the ninth.
It's the ninth now. Well, it's still pretty big. And if it ever happens, and if it happens in California, or if it happens anywhere, Ellen, it'll really be your doing more than anybody else's that made this thing possible, because you've done such extraordinary work, not just your two books, but the Public Banking Institute, exactly, that you set up. I mean, that's part of it, and the people involved. I mean, this is really. I mean, talk about with limited or virtually no funds, that you, an ordinary person, other people around you, ordinary people, can get a major idea circulated, get the idea spreading, get the idea growing. And one of these days, maybe in our lifetime, Ellen, we're going to see this thing take root and something wonderful happen. And that would be wonderful. And literally, you would be the one. You would have ended up being the prime mover for this, that just has shaken the world, maybe get a public banking system established in a place like California, really giving it the shove it needs to move to other states. And it's possible that could literally be the impetus that could get us out from under the corrupted system we have now. That would be a marvelous thing if it ever happened.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I have to agree that California seems like the place, because so many progressive ideas come out of California. It's just a different, there's a different mentality here. I don't know if it's because the pioneers all pushed westward or what, but, you know, the East is more conservative and more just, I don't know. It seems to me that, well, they always say California dreaming, and of course we had the hippies of the 60s, which was my generation. But it seems to me that we'd have a larger, well, I don't know if we have a larger vision, but anyway, it does seem like a lot of ideas get pushed forward in California.
Well,
I felt that when I came back to LA. Sorry?
I lived there twice. Once I had no choice. Uncle Sam sent me to Fort Ord, California. So, I mean, they didn't allow me to vote on it. They just sent me there. But if you had to go anywhere, that certainly was not the worst place. Monterey, Carmel Valley, Pebble Beach, really very, very lovely. So it was really in the 1950s. Nobody took any shots at me. It was a very calm time. But Southern California, San Diego, in the late 1960s. And, there was a certain specialness that I went through. For me, it was a little bit different because I was getting a new business going in Southern California that we spread to the Midwest and other areas. So in that respect, it was different. But it was a very lovely time and, again, very special for me that ended up my spending 3.5 decades or so involved in this thing. Not enough time in California, I would say that. Most of it in Chicago, but California was the beginning for me, and the excitement is always at the beginning.
Yeah, and there's in Mendocino County, they have a group that's really pushing for a county-owned bank, and they've got the mentality. I mean, up in Mendocino County, it's farmers. Well, there's a lot of marijuana growers up there. I mean, they're really cowboys. They're really individualists. Or, in fact, there has been talk of breaking off into their own state. But they just have that, you know, the very individualistic, we can do it, rather like the North Dakotans did in 1919. They're pretty isolated up there in the north, and here all their money was going to Wall Street, and they just very sensibly said, there's no need for us to be sending all of this money off to Wall Street. We can do this in right here in our own state. We want to keep our money in the state. So even though they're a totally conservative Republican state, they have this, they're the only state that has this socialist engine known as a state-owned bank. They also have a state-owned granary, which came out of that same period.
And
so to them, it's not a socialist idea. It's a sovereignty idea. It's
absolutely.
We can do it.
It's a sovereignty idea. It's a make-sense idea. 95 years in running. Ellen, there's a pretty good chance, well, you for certain, pretty good chance maybe I'll be around to witness the centennial of public banking in North Dakota. And wouldn't it be lovely if when we get to that point, we find public banking in a lot more states than just North Dakota?
That's a good point. 1919, yep. 2019.
Well, that would be the wonderful thing to celebrate, not just North Dakota, but the idea that the idea took time to get hold and spread, but it finally did, and other states have adopted it. And of course, wherever it would be adopted, you would see prosperity follow, because North Dakota, in the depths of the 2008 financial crisis, and I remember this, North Dakota had its most profitable year in its history. I don't know what North Dakota's profitability is now, but certainly with public banking, you can have a system that is so effective and so efficient, and it just runs rings around the system that we have now run by Wall Street. We need to get that. We need to spread it, Ellen. Absolutely. We've got a few minutes left. What else is cooking that's important that you want to get in?
Well, I'm running for treasurer. I just had a thought on that recently. There's a panel I'm going to, or a presentation I'm going to tonight. It's put on by KPFK, and it's on community banks. And this woman that is organized our LA City Bank group, she was quite outraged that they hadn't asked me to be on the panel. And so she asked the guy that organized it, and he said, oh, she was the first person we thought of, but we can't put her on because she's running for office, and we'd have to have all the candidates on. And I've run up in that. So my point is, I actually thought that by running for office, I would be able to get this idea out there more than otherwise. You know, it'd be a new opportunity to get this idea out there. But in fact, I'm seeing that one way they suppress the third party non-big party candidates is that you can't speak about your platform, because all these groups that would support me, even including my own group, the Public Banking Institute, can't do it because they're 501c3s, and you're not allowed to talk about candidates unless, of course, you put them all on, which nobody can afford to do.
It's only the ones
that can afford TV ads that can get out there.
I got to sign off, Ellen. I'll tell you this. You can have this program as a platform to promote your candidacy any day, now, next week, anytime you wish. I'll even be your campaign manager.
Thanks,
Stephen. Ellen, I look forward to having you back for more. Terrific program. Always a great discussion on the economy and finance and public banking. Many, many thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll pre-record Thursday and Friday, and we'll be on live Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.